This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is the second side of tape 538, March the 28th, 1982. A long article by Charles Macheline Jr. from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He wrote this article for the Los Angeles Times. As I say, it's titled The Nazi Legacy, Military Might in Latin America, and it's also a full three-quarter page story in the San Jose Mercury, March 21st, 1982. El Presidente is saluting in a uniform, and he has a gun in his hand, and he's got dollars in his pocket. The article says, briefly, the brutality of military culture in the former Spanish colonies is almost inconceivable by the Anglo-Saxon standards, and shows up its worst in El Salvador and Guatemala. And it cites statistics: in 2 years in El Salvador, 25,000 people have been killed in crossfire. Not only killed in combat, but they were tortured, mutilated, butchered in cold blood. And every night, men and women are dragged from their homes by armed men. Mutilated corpses turn up on the roadside ditches. In the last 60 days before the election, 400 to 800 villagers have been massacred. In Guatemala, whole villages of Indians, spectrum of intelligentsia, journalists, teachers, social workers, students, doctors have been killed in political violence. These atrocities are not just tragic byproduct of a civil war. They are not accidental. They are not understood by the American public, and they are concealed by the Reagan administration. And the fact is that the Latin American military in Salvador, Guatemala, Argentina, it doesn't even mention Chile, was devised not only by the Nazis, but earlier by the Spanish and carried on by the Nazis, perfected in Argentine. Latin military staffs involved torture and murder of anyone suspected of even associating with subversives. Guilt or innocence is immaterial. The object is to exterminate the opposition by cowing the sympathizers into submission, deprive the guerrillas of support. The brutal military tradition was handed down from the savage conquistadors, and the dictators took over. They've been a plague on the people ever since. Then it goes into the fact that the Americans, for 20 years, the Pentagon has lavished training and equipment on the Latin American military at the bases in the United States and the United States Army School of the Canal Zone. Under the guise of civic action, we've trained them. We have not weeded out drug racketeers and war criminals. And it goes into the fact of, since World War II, these people have acted worse and are indistinguishable from the people, the criminals that were hung in Nuremberg. They not only were indistinguishable, but only a fraction were hung, and the rest are out doing the same thing in South America. They left easily, went down there, and people like Joseph Mengele from Auschwitz was living, people like him, he and others were living in Germany, enjoying German life, getting back into official positions of police, government, intelligence, security, and were never published, nor were the people who carried on the orders for them in the concentration camps or made the gas, corporations like IG Farben. They get promotions, such as Mr. Peter Grace, who works with Otto Ambrose, the chemist of the extermination plans. And top Nazis have continued. They have never been punished. They've been respected. And the point is that the CIA, as I say, was formed by them, by the Nazis. And until, if I have to repeat this every week, until people get into their heads, we had no CIA intelligence until the Nazis came to this country and told us how to pattern it after the Gestapo. And after the agreement was made to form the CIA, Harry Truman was shocked and said directly, we have a Gestapo in this country. This article goes into the United States that led, allegedly, a crusade against Nazi evil and now supports the methods of Heinrich Himmler's extermination squads, and that's an outrage. Now, the only way of exterminating American Indians or Indians in Chile or in Peru or in Brazil or in Paraguay or all of South America is to sterilize them, which is happening now, and give them poisons and diseases. We are eliminating the Indian population from the globe. Maybe in 20 years, there will not be native Indians in North or South America. And the point is that the poor Indian cannot speak for himself. So who is being killed? The politician or the educated Indian who wants something better for his mother, his family, his brother, himself. It's the people working their way up in the system who are having their heads cut and arms cut off and their entrails cut out, just as the Tsarists did to the Jews at the time of pogroms and so forth. And Hitler did, breaking into homes and having the terror that he spread around. I mentioned Mr. Grace. There's one person who wanted to stop the appointment of Grace for this position that Ronald Reagan has put him in. I mentioned that position as chairman of the Presidential Study Group, because, and Mr. Grace has been a partner of Otto Ambrose, who devised the slave labor camps. He also worked very hard with the poison gases and the slave labor, and worked with the overthrow of Allende down in Chile. And now he knows how to take care of our poor and our uneducated and our masses in this country. And Ronald Reagan has sent him to take care of the private sector survey on cost control, which means how do you cut out giving money to the blacks and the poor while we get our cost overruns. Representative Tom Lantos, a Democrat of California, urged to stop the appointment of this Mr. Grace to this position, but I do not see any other newspaper, except it was the B'nai B'rith Messenger in Los Angeles, had an article about the Nazi role. We saw articles about the Nazi role of Mr. Grace with Otto Ambrose of IG Farben, but I haven't seen any other public officials trying to stop the appointment. And along with J. Peter Grace, who's chairman of the Grace Company, works with the Flick Group and IG Farben, the chemical group. They're just practically one organization with three different names. Along with that, as director of that group, as the president named James W. Nance to assist Mr. J. Peter Grace in this job. Now, Mr. Nance was a deputy to Richard Allen when Richard Allen was being investigated for his Japanese connections. I saw a picture of him over in Japan again this week, all smiles still. This Mr. Nance was in the Navy, and he was an aide to Senator Jesse Helms. Senator Jesse Helms is the gentleman from North Carolina, who one of the few in the Congress who has been objecting to the genocide treaty ever since he's been in public life, that he doesn't want the genocide treaty signed, which means that the anti-genocide resolution is something offensive to him. This came up after he was first elected into the Senate, and he not only has links to a lot of Nazis and the Nazi and the Klan in North Carolina, his benevolent state, but he is against the genocide treaty. And now the man, the admiral or the Navy commander who was the aide to Mr. Senator Helms, is going to be the assistant with J. Peter Grace, and the beat goes on and on. Now, I mentioned the provocateur element in the SLA story, and there's a direct parallel to what was going down in El Salvador. And I might have mentioned this before, but I don't think I went into the details of this story. It was from the Baltimore Sun and from the Washington Post, and again, not a wire service story. So many of you who hear these broadcasts don't get these in your local newspapers if you're not tapped into those papers. The story title reads, Salvador Ransom Kidnap Ring, Rich Playboy Admits Heading the Salvador Group. Now, the gist of the story is that a group of very wealthy people, including a man who's a security guard for Bayer Aspirin, which is IG Farben, and for Nestle's, and many of you know the story of the Nestle's milk formula and the holdings of that Swiss chocolate company, the guy who sets up security for these firms, kidnapped a member of a wealthy family down in El Salvador. And then he goes to the family, puts him in a high-rise apartment with all kinds of contacts, and goes to the family and tells them how sorry he is and asks for a $5 million ransom has been asked for this person. And he's with the person who's kidnapped, and he's with the family who's supposed to give up the ransom, but they don't know it's the same person that's doing all this. The story goes, San Salvador, discovery of a wealthy playboy posing as a revolutionary to commit kidnapping suggests that criminal opportunities may be taking over where the guerrillas left off in El Salvador. Mr. Roeder, a 35-year-old former Army major, admits leading a gang who kidnapped two of his wealthy friends, Mr. Bustamante Augsburg in December of 81 and Roberto Seaman in September 1980, and wanted $5 million. Roeder, a well-connected playboy, travels continuously between Miami, was president of the Salvadoran Institute of Industrial Promotion in the 1970s during the regime of President Molina. Until his arrest in January, he also headed the largest security firm guarding executives from companies like Bayer, Aspirin, Bayer Chemical, and Nestle's of El Salvador. Now he goes to the families, and the article says instead of a sleazy guerrilla hangout, the police found Bustamante, the man who was kidnapped, in a swank apartment filled with an arsenal of weapons, linked with Roeder's officials here in Miami. They had a telex machine, a two-way radio transmitter, closed circuit television. I call it a circus because that's what it is, television, and they are keeping this person who's kidnapped instead of being mistreated or tied up in an apartment. And then they go, the kidnappers, to the family and tell them how sorry they are and how badly they feel. Now, that's exactly what I wrote happened at the SLA, where wealthy people, Emily and William Harris, with college degrees, and Angela and Gary Atwood come out from Indiana and get involved with Donald DeFries, who's an intelligent agent working with the LAPD, their CIA counterintelligence group, and they kidnapped heiress Patty Hearst and let her watch television at Disneyland and kill a few people in Los Angeles and carry on a two-year story as an excuse for SWAT teams to come in to find terrorists, to create terrorism, to identify the so-called left in the Bay Area, and comforting Randolph Hearst and Catherine Hearst, well, they all along know where Patty Hearst was. This is exactly what was happening, and this is continuing to happen, because if there are no genuine guerrillas, you have to keep doing this in order to keep the guerrilla story going. Mr. Cummings, who was one of the few Jewish appointments of Ronald Reagan to the ambassador to Vienna, put him in a strategic place where, A, he could be blown up easily. Another terrorist story would be, you know, over the news media, and you could wipe out your Jewish ambassador at the same time. Or they could use him to antagonize the Soviet Union, because through Vienna, Russian Jews were coming. And instead of going to Israel, where they promised the Russians they would go, they're siphoning him in the United States for anti-Soviet propaganda. Well, Mr. Cummings had a heart attack in January and came home from Vienna, and he was at Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, and my family said, promise you won't tell. Of course, couldn't put on the radio. He was there, and he was home for a short time. It's a big secret that the ambassador to Vienna was at Cedars of Lebanon Hospital in Los Angeles since January, and nobody in the news media or other people could be told that. Now, if it was really a heart attack, it seems to me that everyone would know how he is and want to know how he is. And Mr. Cummings died this week of cancer. He just died while I was down in Los Angeles this week. I was down the time that he was admitted to the hospital. And so now he has his 2 or 3 months, maybe his Jack Ruby or Martha Mitchell cancer. Now the Jew is home from Vienna. And the conversation is there. It's really good that he was back in Los Angeles, because the terrorists would have killed him there, that he had 20 guards and a bulletproof car and his life was in danger and he shouldn't have been there, the terrorists. Terrorism is the conversation, not the links, Washington Post, New York Times, Time Magazine, the links of the terrorists to the CIA or the Jack Anderson syndication that comes out with the CIA protecting the terrorists. Those people who want to believe it hang on to the thing that the terrorists are the baddies, even though there are direct links to the intelligence community. So there was an article in the LA Times this week that Mr. Cummings died in Los Angeles from cancer and not from a terrorist in Vienna. And the beat goes on and on. There is nothing to keep conversation and lips going back and forth and to find a terrorist. So that down in El Salvador, a group that are in charge of security for the multinational corporations and the IG Farbens and Bayer and Nestle's and 98 other companies that aren't even listed. You can imagine what the others, a total of 100 are, if Nestle's and IG, Bayer Aspirin, are two of his clients. So he takes the member of the wealthy family, puts him in a high rise with all kinds of entertainment, tells the family how sorry he is. Maybe they get the $5 million that they can't get out of the country, and then go to Miami and parlay that $5 million into cocaine from Colombia and make $25 million. So they can keep a member of the family locked up and have $25 million for weapons and guns to fight the native population, all under the guise of helping fine, the ransom money would put out for this person, and all the time he's safe in a high-rise apartment. The whole thing is so disgusting, but it has a pattern, and it repeats itself over and over. And as I said before, the shocker, or it's no shocker, of a man coming from Vienna and Munich intelligence to make a rapprochement with Richard Nixon, with his links to the Nazis, when Kurt George Kissinger is the Chancellor of Germany, is another repetition of a sad story. This just came out in the New York Times in March of this year, that story that I did so much about on the first half of this tape. But remember in 1972, the summer of 72, when I wrote, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? It goes into the warfare state, into John Foster Dulles, into the use of Reinhard Gehlen, into the Nazis, into the German specialists, the Cold War, J. Edgar Hoover, and their Nazi connections, and their use of Richard Nixon for their front man. All of that I knew 10 years ago when I wrote that article. And now the documents are coming out how they all cooperated in 1968, February 68, why Lyndon Johnson was still president when the archives were emptied of these 57 volumes of indexes with the CIA. We didn't even yet have Richard Nixon as a conduit or connection. So it's a continuous process. It isn't Republicans and it isn't Democrats. It's a question of fascists who want to maintain a status quo order of control over the economy and the labor market without competing or giving fair wages and exterminating those people that they think are ugly or deformed or unusual, and using people as you do vegetables in a wheat patch or cornfield. People are treated as vegetables, and of course, they seem to like it. They get themselves plowed and seeded and plowed and put into cans, and they dig their own cans or make their own jars or whatever, and they seem to enjoy it. So I only simply describe the situation, not the cure. The San Jose Mercury this last Sunday had a front page story, Hitler's Alive and Other Conspiracies, and the magazine section has a four-page section on Mae Brussel. And those of you that subscribe to the World Watchers and take these tapes regularly, I'll send you out a copy of this article. As I say, I was away last week, but I will have copies made and send them out to you because many of you don't get the San Jose Mercury. The front page of the magazine section is May wearing her shirt that Rush Harp made for the researchers who killed JFK, RFK, MLK, and MJK. MJK was Mary Jo Kopechne, who was murdered so that Ted Kennedy would not be able to run for president, and they would link him, and that wasn't hard to do, to her demise at Chappaquiddick. Big title, Hitler is Alive. The federal government killed John Lennon. Ronald Reagan is a front man for the forces of evil. If you don't believe it, just ask Mae Brussel. And there's an account, Jill Wolfson came to the house, and she came down on a Sunday afternoon and wanted to go to KLRB with me, and was there when I did the broadcast, and then she came and spent the night and left the next morning, and it sounds like we're sitting there just eating a lot of meals. She writes it in it. I don't know. I can't be objective about these kind of things. I think it's a fairly good article. Every time I read articles about myself, or most of the time, they don't really say, you know, if you wanted a point to be made, to be remembered about you, to people who don't know you, what would you want and how could you support that information? You know, what is it you're doing and why are you doing it? It isn't a bad story, and it did make the front page of the San Jose Mercury Sunday paper and the front page of the magazine section, so it called attention to World Watchers. And the gist of the program was about World Watchers. And I'm going to do many tapes in the near future on the Dutch resistance, the Battle at Malmondy, the Battle of the Bulge, the betrayal at Arnhem that I referred to from time to time. And in this article, she said, getting a fix on the number of bona fide world watchers is like asking a government official how many central military advisors there are in Central America. Well, you know, many people want to know who's listening to the radio, who gets the cassettes, how many go out. To tell you the truth, I don't have the faintest idea. We make the tapes, as she said in the story. We have some duplicated. We send to people, and they have them duplicated. And there's people that will tell you that have this program on other radio stations, and I think they tell me about 17 times a year what the call letters are and want me to remember them and write them down. But that isn't my role. My role is to do research and get it out to you and study. And it's interesting if people call in a certain city and say, where can I find this program? But it's more interesting for them to really search for it and get the material and books. I don't want them to work for it, but there's a lot you have to do yourselves, and it's not part of my mentality to keep remembering. All I do is answer the mail I get, and it comes from many, many states. You'd be surprised how many, and people asking for the sheets that go with the tapes, and I just don't even want to estimate. I want to see when I'm completed with 1 week's broadcast, see what's the most important thing for you the next week, the week after, to keep you on top of these stories. And finally, to conclude, there was an interview with Mr. Mallet, M-A-L-L-E, regarding that movie, My Dinner with Andre, and I mentioned it briefly before. Why did I like that movie so much? I believed it should have been nominated for the Best Picture of the Year, because it's about two people, whether, as I said before, there's an alienation there, there's an estrangement, but there's an effort on one person to get through, to communicate, to tell what he's doing, to share his ideas. It may not be that he's doing it successfully, but he's making the effort, where one is enthusiastic. And Mallet directed the movie Atlantic City also. I didn't see that, but I saw this one. And he says, it's unbelievable, this is one of the quotations from this story, it's unbelievable that a movie would be made of a conversation piece, that there's just two people that come into a restaurant. He says, what's amazing is that people go back and back to see this movie. Nobody in his right mind can come up with an explanation of the success of this thing. I could give you a lot of good reasons why it was not going to work. A friend of mine came up with the explanation that there are a lot of people out there that aren't capable of making conversation themselves anymore. I call this the television age, of course. If they ever could, they can't now. So it is a great relief for them to go and pay their money and sit and listen to a conversation. An old friend from years before comes in and has dinner with another friend, and one's 10 years younger, and they work together in the theater. They have their dinner and they leave. But they have a conversation, and that's the entire movie, except for a waiter that comes and takes the order, brings it, and clears the table. And he said, if this is the case, we'd have a whole series of sequels of conversations. Mallet says it could become a cinematic genre of the conversation piece, you know, that's part of a discussion. The movie says people don't have time. They go home and watch television, so the art of conversation is lost. I'm curious to see what it's going to be like when the movie is on television, because then you can bring your TV dinner and sit and have dinner with Andre when they bring it to television, so that these two men, Wallace Shawn and Andre Gregory, are having their dinner, and you can eat your dinner and just sit and listen to them talk. And how many times have you been somewhere where two people are talking and you're just listening to them talk, and the conversation is out of your realm, but either one of them interests you and you're there? Well, why am I so fascinated with this particular movie and bring it up several times on this program when there's so many earth-shaking things going on? I think because when the program first started, it was called Dialogue Conspiracy. And people said to me, well, it's not a talk show or a call-in show. Where's the dialogue? And I said, you are supposed to take this program and take notes before I had the tapes or lectures that I do or the articles I've done. But the radio program, it's going on 11 years, and the tapes have been available since 1977, and the reels have been right from the beginning. You're supposed to play them with your friends, and then you have a conversation. If you read a book that's interesting, you should have a conversation with people. If you hear something on the news, you have a conversation, whether Mr. Doge was kidnapped that day or whether a house burned down, a bathhouse in San Francisco, and different people persecuting the gays around the country in the bathhouses, or whatever it is you're interested in. You have conversations. There's newspapers on ecology. There's movements to stop nuclear weapons and so forth. So you're supposed to take these broadcasts and listen to them and talk about them. If you think the material is too controversial, then you probably won't listen again. If you think there's a grain of truth, you might listen. But I hope that there is this dialogue, because the kind of people I'm trying to reach are not the ones that are sitting and watching television on Sunday night or the radio programs. They're not listening to KGO or call things. They're listening to Mae Brussels share many books that you can talk about, many movies you can talk about, many dictators you can talk about, many countries that are being overthrown, tortures, mind control, so forth. The role of Nazis since before Hitler came to power on up to the present day. There are a lot of subjects, so you're not limited to one, but at least have a conversation about it and have some concern about it. And it may not always work. You may be with people who aren't interested, and you'll have to find other people who are. Now, that book, My Dinner with Andre, it's out as a book. I was going to go to the movie and tape record it and type it up for you, but it is out as a book, and you can get it, Grove Press. It just came out because many of you don't have the art theaters in the towns where you'd like to see the movie. And after they keep talking, Andre is filled with enthusiasm. He's searching all over the world for the meaning of life. He hasn't found it yet. And the tragedy is, the real tragedy is that the meaning of life is in the history that we are giving, that he is giving to his daughter, Marina, or to his son. The real life is what we do with those that are next to us, Nicholas, his wife, Chiquita, and so forth. What kind of a world is Andre going to leave to them? That is very important. He isn't concerned with that. He's concerned with them in a sense, but he has to find something for himself. And Wally is just sitting there, you know, listening to him, and he's not connecting. And any of you who take this research seriously or listen, as I say, want to connect with people who probably have the same response as Wally until you go out and find someone else, because they are out there. I know they are, because the only people I see are the friends I have, except for a few old-timers, are those that have connected to certain truths that are making the world a worse place and to certain truths of people that are trying to make it a better place. And in the script of this play, in this movie, after Andre's done most of the talking, and he talks to Wally, marvelous person, they're real friends, they're not actors. He says, well, Andre, you know, if you want to know my actual response to all this, do you want to hear my response to what you're saying to me? He says, well, Andre, my actual response is I'm trying to survive. You know, I really am trying to earn a living to pay my rent and my bills. I love my life. I enjoy staying home with Debbie. I'm reading Charlton Heston's autobiography, and that's that. I mean, occasionally, maybe we step out, go to a dinner party, and I mean, I have a list of errands and responsibilities, and I keep a notebook, and I enjoy going through my list and carrying out the responsibilities and doing the errands and crossing them off my list. And I don't know how anybody could enjoy anything more than I enjoy reading Charlton Heston's autobiography. And I don't think I feel the need for anything more than all this. Now, the tragedy, of course, is that Wally is happy with what he's got. He's got the bestseller. He says, I don't even know what you're talking about. I mean, I know that what you're talking about, but I don't really know what you're talking about. Actually, even if I did feel the way you do, there's no possibility for happiness now. I couldn't accept the idea that the way to make life wonderful would be to totally reject Western civilization and fall into a belief of some weird thing. He says, I don't even know how I'd go about it. And the point, getting back to this character, Wally, is that he makes his list and he reads Charlton Heston. But then someday he has to take his list and read about Walter Dornberger or Kirk George Kissinger or Joseph Mengele's or Martin Bormann. And he has to learn about the Gestapo and the SS. And he has to make his list of gas mask, shovel, food supplies for survival, burial place, will, last wishes, etc., etc. His list either changes drastically or it never changes. And then all he has to do is to just take off his clothes and go for a shower, and that's the end. They pulled the plug, and he's had what he thinks is his shower, and then they bring in the man who yanks the gold out of the teeth and cuts his hair for pillows, takes the skin for lampshades, and that's it. Some people are just meant for that role of doing what they want to do and staying at that level until the end comes sweetly or cruelly. And there are other people who want to change those things that happened to people in the past and don't want to see them happen in the future. And there's people like Andre who want to change all this but haven't found the answer yet. They're still searching. They're off somewhere. Now, do your conversations, meet your people or family members, talk about these things and have a dialogue. And the less tube, the better. That's what it's about. And see if we can't solve some of these problems before this planet is totally ruined. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel. It's time to close now. I'll be back with you next week. Take care. And I'm sorry about the delay in the tape this week.